Hello.
How are you?
All right, just took a hit of Tylenol. I'm all doped up, ready to go.
This movie give you a headache?
No. It's just my general state of being, mm-hmm. which involves pain.
Oh.
But yeah, it's been approximately an hour since I finished watching the movie, and I've mostly forgotten about it. So that's, you know, where I'm at over here.
Well, that's a good sign. I mean, they say that a good part of memory is that we forget things that give us pain that we can't learn from. So I think that's important.
Is that why we're doomed to repeat the past?
Yes, but...
we forget the pain?
And make all new mistakes this time.
Well, I don't know how new the mistakes are. I was looking at the little gif that you just tweeted. It's very apt.
Yes. And Dan is of course referring to the fact that we record this live on a weekly basis and tweet about it from our show account. And
live from New York City. It's whatever day of the week we decide to record.
Live from San Diego. It's Jurassic Live. Anyway, we tweet things sometimes, and I try to pick a funny little gif, and we got the Jeff Goldblum saying, "Hang on, this is going to be bad," right before the trailer's knocked over the cliff, in the movie that we just watched, because it's a movie where they do that. They do things. They like stuff to do.
I don't know where to start with this movie. It's bad.
Yeah, it's real bad.
I feel like we should spend some time trying to figure out why it's bad, because I don't understand mm-hmm. why it's so bad. Because we've got, well, I know why individually the pieces are bad, but we got the same director, Mr. Steven Spielberg, who is mm-hmm. a very talented man. We've got the same writer, David Koepp. We've got the same editor. We have a different cinematographer. And we've got a couple of the same actors, but this movie is almost parody of the original level of dumb.
Yes, it's a bunch of people making some mistakes that you would hope they would know better than to make. It's really extremely disappointing. There is a 4-year gap between the first Jurassic Park movie and this movie. It was released in May of 1997. There were parts of it filmed through 1996. There's a lot of post and pre-production stuff that occurred on making this thing happen. It has about 1.5 times the number of dinosaurs that you on screen in terms of screen time as the previous movie. But they certainly rely more on longer CGI moving shots of dinosaurs than they did in the previous one. I would say much to this film's detriment, because they hadn't quite nailed that part of it yet, and it does not age quite as gracefully as even some of the worst-looking shots from the previous film. Also, because they changed cinematographers, because, as Steven Spielberg said, he wanted a darker, more painterly look. He picked
painterly.
That's what he said. Yeah, well, I watched a featurette where he said it with his words in his mouth. But I assume by painterly he just means diffusion. But anyway, we have Janusz Kaminski, who is I think he's a good cinematographer. In other
name some of his other things.
His other things. In this, he's, I don't know what was happening. This is a situation where I prefer the way Dean Cundey had approached Jurassic Park as opposed to this. And I know that there's a lot of like front fill in what Dean Cundey was doing in the first film, but I feel like that really helped sit everything together and integrate it. Whereas I feel like in this one, because of the contrasty nature of doing a lot of like side key, side rim everywhere in these night scenes and stuff, you get a lot of really strange black level issues that were not as pernicious as they are in this one as they were in the previous. It's really perplexing, because I think it makes overall the film worse. However, that is, you know, just like a technical dispute that I'm having with this. It is nothing to do with the actual material of the film, which I think is probably why I focus on the technical way it looks, because I'm so unengaged with the film on an emotional level that all I can do is just pick apart all the things that I'm seeing, because that's all I'm left with. There is nothing in this. There is no purchase for me for emotion. There's nothing for me to grab onto and hold and cherish or even feel sad about or anything. Like, there is no emotion to be had. You are just on a ride that is going forwards, and that is it. And the ride is not engaging with the audience in I feel the way that the previous movie had. In terms of writing, in terms of directing, in terms of acting, in terms of the decision not to rehearse, in all kinds of weird ways that you would think that would not be present. Because as you said, almost everyone involved with the first one is involved with the second one. So how did that happen? It is a real head scratcher, much in the same way as a dinosaur might scratch its head. But
sure. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in what you said there already. And I don't want to sound just completely overly negative all the time. Like, that's not my ambition, but that's
probably
mine. What's going to happen. Well, sure, whatever.
Just joke.
But like, whereas in the first movie, the minor technical errors that you could see were immediately forgotten and excused because there was so much great emotion and character work and drama to focus on. In this movie, it's the exact opposite. There's absolutely nothing of interest to focus on, so you end up just sort of staring at things moving around, and then you realize that they don't make any sense the way they're moving around, and they're unpleasing to stare at. But we have a script that is incredibly wordy, and people are going off on these very kind of like almost Shakespearean soliloquies at each other to try and like explain what they're doing and who they are, but we're telling, not showing at all. So the movie is just insufferable to stare at. I don't know how, another way to describe it. Like, this movie has nothing. This movie has nothing like interesting to intrigue you. Everyone had a bad day on this movie, I guess. I don't know. Like, the writing is bad. The directing, I don't know what Spielberg was doing. Like, I read that quote where he said, you know, his sequels are bad because he gets overconfident and cocky, and then he doesn't put as much focus in or something, and then they just come out bad because he had too much money and he thought it was going to be a hit from the get-go. But like, it seems like he was like over at the craft service table half the time when they were shooting this, because the camera angles are just kind of like, they figured out where the end frame of the move needed to be for some sort of staging, and then they just kind of like gently pushed the dolly to the side 10 feet and they're like, yeah, this is fine, we'll start the framing like this even though it doesn't matter because we're gonna end over there. And then they just like gradually meander over somewhere else 3 minutes later and they're like, cool, great, cut, moving on. No coverage. We don't need anything. We'll just get this at one angle and we're done. It's like, what the hell is happening here?
Yeah. Well, like you said, show and not tell. They did something weird with this one where they are showing us dinosaurs more than what we saw in the previous film, and of more variety and diversity than what we saw in the previous film, even in the same frame. However, it is completely unrelated to the things that these characters are saying to one another, because what they're doing, as you said, is just describing stuff, like just espousing a thing that they have to say and then just moving on to the next thing.
And most of the dinosaurs are just like running, like, mm-hmm. Hey, they're all running that way. Let's also run that way, and also not have any sort of emotional reaction to dinosaurs. Like I said it in the Slack thing, but basically the premise of this is that nobody believed Malcolm when he got back to America and explained what happened. But at the same time, everyone who is on this mission and on this island now is not interested in dinosaurs, is jaded by the dinosaurs, has no awe or respect for the dinosaurs. They're all just like, fake cocky bravado dudes with giant guns, and they're like, yeah, look at me, I'm gonna go take down a dinosaur. That's totally a normal thing that I'm gonna do because I'm me and blah blah.
Yeah, and you even see that with the good guys, the good guy team that we're supposed to be, we're supposed to be to appreciate, we're supposed to like, we're supposed to be on their side. But we have Vince Vaughn, who I find unlikable in the best of circumstances, but he is exceptionally unlikable in this one, where he's supposed to have that moment of awe, him and his co-buddy, the mechanic guy. I can't remember the name of him. Doesn't matter. You got bit in half, like split like a wishbone. But he
there's no reason to remember any of these people's names anyway.
Eddie, that's what his name was. Richard Schiff played Eddie Carr. Character actor Richard Schiff, who you'd recognize from being a character actor in many things and not remember his name.
As Malcolm says, show some respect. He gave his life to protect ours, but we don't really remember his name.
No.
So who cares?
Yeah, because it's such a small role. But anyway, the awe that they're supposed to have in one shot where Vince Vaughn is fiddling with his JVC VHS-C camcorder, and Eddie is on the other side, and Malcolm is sandwiched in the middle of the frame, and he said, what did you think you were going to find here? And Vince Vaughn says, I don't know, like big iguanas or something. And it not only does it undermine like awe, but they just move on so quickly from this one singular shot of that, whatever that was, to just treating it as if they're herding cows. For this whole entire thing, and that they're bad guy cattle rustlers who are on the ranch, and they need to make sure the bad guy cattle rustlers don't rustle their cows. It is...
That's probably the biggest thing in this movie, right? Like, the dinosaurs don't matter at all. It could be literally anything else. This could just take place in the Serengeti, and they're hunting, whatever, elephants or something.
Yeah, the only time where there's actually an appreciation for sort of the mystery of the dinosaurs, I would say, is with the teeny tiny compies. Compos ignatus. Those teeny tiny ones are interesting just because we don't know necessarily exactly how they will approach things and do stuff. But the mystery and interest of that is ruined by the very prolonged death of Peter Stormare in the middle, quote unquote, of this movie. As hard as that is to believe.
Was he in the scene earlier or in a scene earlier that was cut out that would have made us care about his character? Because we don't care about him at all.
No, there is no scene where we care about him, but there is a scene where he is confronted by a compi and he asks the Grateful Dead paleontologist about it, and that guy says that, oh, they're not threatening or whatever. Like, no, probably not a big deal. And so he zaps it with a stun gun. And so we're supposed to appreciate the comeuppance that he receives, I suppose, when all of the compies swarm on him and kill him in the stream, and the stream runs red with his blood, with his CG blood.
And because he makes the incredibly realistic mistake of having his pal... have his back while he uses the restroom 50 yards away for some reason, but his buddy happens to be listening to his favorite rock and roll tapes with his headphones.
You know, some people are shy, but
so you think it's because he's shy he had to go over a hill and down a valley?
I am not one who will judge Peter Stormare, but I will say that his death scene goes on for way too long, especially because it is sandwiched in the middle of a bunch of other stuff that is going on, where we're on a walking montage that is supposed to propel us into the final confrontation, but we have this prolonged death scene for Peter Stormare, who is not really a character, as you pointed out, that we have any association with, other than the fact that he shocked one of these compies at the beginning. And we already know these compies are threatening because of the opening scene, which appears to have come from a direct-to-video sequel to the movie, because it is not shot or acted or written especially well. A rich family is on the island, and their daughter wanders off with a sandwich. Presumably, they do not know what is on this island. They just assume that it is a yachtable island, and so they yacht it. And there is one shot goes from the yacht to a guy walking with champagne in the middle distance to a guy up close with the champagne, and we can see it's Pierre Jouet. And so that way we know it's real champagne and we can say that, and it's not just bubbly or sparkling wine, which we'd have to say if it was something other than something from the Champagne region of France. So that is an important detail for us as people podcasting.
Criticism.
Yeah.
But you know, this opening scene was shot by Second Unit, is that correct?
Yes. It was shot entirely by Second Unit, and Second Unit is the it was directed by the writer of the film, David Cobb.
If I had to think of a situation that I think might actually be plausible compared to the rest of this film, how this movie became what it was, I feel like the Second Unit team went, all right, how would Spielberg stage this? He's very good at doing depth staging and motion and moving things. And then they shot that scene, and then Spielberg saw that and went, is that what I do, really? And then he tried. He was in his head for the rest of the movie going, is that really what I do? And then was like trying to mimic that scene that was mimicking him throughout the rest of the movie, just like every other day, like head in his hands, like, I don't know what really, what, so what am I supposed to, how do I move cameras? Like, I forget how things, like, just do what they did in the first, well, we can't do the depth staging because we're in a forest and we have, you know, trees on one side and trees on the right side. And then like actors can only be in the middle because we didn't build the other stuff. So I guess just like put them there and then we'll have somebody walk up really close to frame and we'll be low and look at their face for some reason because we built really tall trees. So let's use the trees. And then I don't know. Is this good, guys? Is this bad? Like, I don't know what to do here. And then he's so in his head that he forgets to direct the actors, so they say things that sound like people.
Yeah. So anyway, the important part of this is we get the comp. We already know the compies are threatening. So it is not a surprise that they're threatening later on, and we're just waiting for this guy to die. And it just takes forever. See what seems like forever in this movie time. And this is also, coincidentally, the longest Jurassic Park franchise film runtime of 129 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have made this mistake before film as a filmmaker, where you stage scenes that have very long takes that move from character to character and set piece to set piece. And then you get into the edit and you're like, oh no, this is really long and slow. We need to get from the beginning of the shot to the end of the shot a lot faster, but we don't have coverage because I designed this to like follow the people. Like, how do I get there? I guess I literally just have to sit here and suffer through watching this camera move way too slowly from the beginning of the shot to the end of the shot. And suddenly you have a 2 hour and 9 minute long movie that sucks.
Yeah. And like you're saying, it's not just this opening sequence that does this. I mean, the whole film, there's so many shots where we are very wrapped up in moving with things that are happening inside of the scene, and we're not cutting away to anything, which is exceptionally strange because it can take a very long time for these characters to hit these marks that they're supposed to be standing on, and it really feels like they've hit that mark. They really feel like they landed and they waited and they pause on where they're supposed to be standing because they know, they've talked to the director right before this about where they're supposed to go. So you see it when these characters are having, like the subway scene, when we cut from the island to the subway. And there is the tropical backdrop, which is an advertisement that Jeff Goldblum walks off of. Then he steps near a door that doesn't open, up to another door that does open, walks into that one, and the camera goes through the first door that he didn't walk through. And then we are with him for that. And it's like, what? Why did we do that? I'm not really clear on that, other than we could do that with a camera. But then we cut to his ridiculous conversation that he has with the guy on the train. Then we have another like weird long tracking shot where we're inside John Hammond's home, and he is talking to John Hammond, and we're going back and forth between the desk. And then we have another really strange one when he's at the mechanics before they go to the island, and he's talking to his daughter. And the camera is going back and forth between the two of them as they ping pong through the set and just stop in certain places where they have their marks to deliver their lines. And we just ping pong back to whatever we're supposed to be doing. I do realize I should say, I guess, table tennis back and forth between what they're supposed to be doing. But we're just like, the camera is bouncing around between these things happening, and we're not cutting away to anything. So there's no compression of time. So we really feel the extra time while we're waiting around for them to go from one position to the next position. And there is no reason for them to be moving other than the dialogue they have is so unanimated and expository that there is no way to make the scene interesting other than to have your characters move through the set so that something is happening. Because otherwise, they would just be talking and delivering lines to one another in a very long monologue, which is
these actors
fault
never
the
even had a chance. They never had a chance with this dialogue. Like, let's name all of the things that we learned in that scene with Malcolm and Hammond. There is a secondary island, Site B. That's where they developed the dinosaurs. InGen wants to take it over, but it had sort of like collapsed or something, and then it had created a sort of a self-sustaining life had found a way, and the dinosaurs are flourishing on their own magically. They want to, you know, go in there, capture the dinosaurs, put them in some sort of theme park again. Hammond wants to be a fun naturalist guy now and say, like, let the dinosaurs be dinosaurs because, look, this is the magic of nature. He's sending an observation team to go there and take pictures and videos and stuff to see what the animals are like in their native habitat before the InGen jerks show up and blow everything up. Also, one of those people happens to be Malcolm's girlfriend. Please, Malcolm, go there and help them out. She already left 2 days ago. Everyone else is going in 3 days. Did I miss anything? Like, all of these things happen in a couple of minutes. What else happened? There was more stuff.
Well, there is a momentary mention of his deteriorating health, which is leaned on by having Hammond have a difficult time of getting out of bed and having a difficult time of getting his cane to get across the room to get the binders.
Also, there's an IV in the background next to the bed.
Yes, which is not in or plugged in at any point, but it is there to show you he is in ill health. And then he somehow miraculously is healed and is ambling around without the cane at all, or with any assistant, any assistance getting up or out of the bed. So it is a weird scene because they spent so much time focusing on him being in ill health at the start of it. By the end of it, he's just like getting up and out of bed, just I guess because of the economy of the scene, they couldn't have him be sitting in the bed and to deliver this expository dialogue because it'd be boring, but they also didn't want to have another thing of him being helped out of bed. So what they did was they just settled on this thing of suddenly he's healed, or I guess he was feeling better.
No, he's not feeling better. He's losing his mind because after Malcolm goes like, fine, I'm going and I'm going to get her out of there, he turns around and he's holding his binders, like his giant thick binders of like the dossier of his people. And he counts to four on his fingers to go like, oh, look at me. I got all four of my people now. And then walks back to his bed like, really, Hammond? You needed to count to four on your fingers? 3 + 1 = 4? Yeah, it's 4. But like, I don't blame the actors because obviously they're very talented people.
Oh, yes.
But it's just like I guess the script is an issue because they when you cram that much into this one scene, they don't stand a chance of being able to perform any particular emotion or, I don't know, have any sort of effect on the audience other than conveying all this information. And we're just sitting there letting it wash over us, watching these people walk back and forth from a bed to a desk and back and again. And it's just like, what the hell? Why do I care? I don't care. There is no interest in these people at all. It's all about information. And what is the general plot of this movie? Like, we just spend the rest of the movie watching the jerky InGen guys try to tranquilize and kidnap like one or two, like they're doing like a Noah's Ark. They're trying to grab like one of every species. Instead of taking the embryos like Nedry, they're taking full blown species back to San Diego with them to put them in like a little gladiator kind of auditorium thing where I'm sure they would be totally separated from the people. It wouldn't kill them at all.
No.
And they're going to transport them back via boat to San Diego.
The weird thing is we don't even find out that's what their plan is until he's giving that weird satellite board speech in the middle of the jungle. In the middle of the plains or whatever.
Right. He's broadcasting live on TV. And the part where he said, like, you know, they built a fully functioning auditorium here and he was weeks away from opening it, but he gave up and abandoned it. But we're going to make one in San Diego. It's like, why did we need to know there was one on this island?
No.
You told us that you're taking them.
That was he was telling you about the San Diego one.
See, It sounded like he said there was one on Site B, and then they made another one in San Diego.
No, they had one in San Diego before Hammond realized he wanted it to be a fully immersive island experience, before he did the islands. So he had a partially finished auditorium. And,
okay, I take back some of what I said about the performances in this movie, because in the first movie, I talked about how much I loved the scene where we met Muldoon, and they were the two conversations sort of talking over each other, and it's very important dialogue, even though you can't necessarily, like, you could miss it very easily. In this movie, there are a lot of people who are mumbling dialogue at each other that is incredibly meaningless, but you can't really tell what they're saying because you hear words that sound like they might be useful, but they're not.
Well, it's not useful because Arliss Howard, who's playing the nephew of John Hammond, who is the evil bad guy in this, so to speak, Peter Ludlow, he's tasked with this sort of amorphous and very strange thing of having to be this person who's coming up with the commercial aspect of this, somehow surviving in this natural environment, which seems incredibly deadly in terms of body count and all other things. But he also sort of mumbles through and is a coward about how he wants to handle like virtually every aspect of this film. It is incredibly bizarre how they chose to go with that. He's very unlike Hammond, but he's also very unlike any like believable character. He just winds up sort of filling the sort of evil capitalist mold, where it doesn't really feel grounded by any particular characteristics that he has. He supposedly is envious of Hammond and supposedly wants to take up his mantle and have that fame associated with him. But I don't really buy it from his performance or the dialogue that he is supposed to be delivering. There is, of course, an exchange with Ian Malcolm and Ludlow at the docks when Ian Malcolm whispers in his ear, "Now you're John Hammond," after everything goes awry at the docks. But that
when the writer wrote that line on his keyboard, he did a fist pump in the air after that because he's like, "Yes, this line, so good."
But it's not. It doesn't feel grounded in anything because there is a Tyrannosaurus that just ran out of there. You wouldn't be leaning in to whisper a quippy line to someone right then.
No.
Like,
not at all.
No, it is bizarre. Okay, so let's talk about one major flaw that this movie has.
let's pick one of them. Which one you were talking about?
Yeah, let's talk about an enormous flaw in the construction of the film, and that is San Diego. The first part of this film up to their rescue from the island is an actual complete movie that you could spend more time on and iterate on writing and flesh it out. The additional, 20, 30 minutes that are tacked on for San Diego is an entirely different beast that is incredibly different from the journey that we'd been on so far in this film and also the journey we had been on in the previous film. It is an homage to monster films, like King Kong, Godzilla, etc. There are visual homages. Visual homages. There are auditory in terms of like sound design and the musical score. They chose to put in like some timpanis going like boom 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 when the T-Rex is going out of the dock, and it's just like, this is ridiculous, guys. Like, we're not in. You know, this isn't the 1920s. This isn't a 1960s Godzilla film. Like, this is, you need to take it more seriously. And when they do these homages, it's almost it is to the point of parody, but to the point of parody where it's not funny. It is sort of a deadpan parody. It is incredibly strange. Like, there are Japanese businessmen in the middle of the night running from the T-Rex. Why? Why does that shot exist? Other than we want to have a Godzilla homage in here. There is a scene with, like I said, the boom, 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 boom of the T-Rex escaping. And that is an homage to the King Kong, music score from what was it? Max Steiner, I think. That is just like silly stuff that's in here that it doesn't have anything to do with the characters at all whatsoever.
Remember the funny part where the T-Rex drinks out of the pool and then eats a dog?
Yeah. Well, supposedly, Steven Spielberg was on a vacation in, I think somewhere in Long Island, and in the backyard, he looked out the window and saw the pool, and he was like, oh, wouldn't it be great if there was a T-Rex there? And so he went and wrote that into the movie afterwards. So there is so much of this that is just shoehorned in at the end, where it's just like, oh, I want to have my monster movie, like when I was a kid, of a monster in the city, in society, wrecking stuff, just like what I had seen. And I went to do that.
The T-Rex runs down the street and it sees a streetlight right in front of its face, so it bites the streetlight because it's like, what is this thing hanging out in front of me? As if a T-Rex had never seen a tree branch before in its life.
Well, and there's also the stuff with like the gas station. I think this is the only movie where we see a T-Rex with a out-of-focus Chevron sign behind it. And then we have the rolling 76... gas station signage. There are a lot of sign jokes in this movie.
That is such a bad edit, too, where the Malcolm like flinches, and then they cut to that other angle, and you see the ball rolling by. You can almost hear Spielberg in the background yelling, and flinch! And because he does this really over-the-top like arm flail, like, oh my god, there's a thing coming at me! And then we cut away, and we're like, oh, there's the thing rolling past him.
There are so many things in this movie where it feels like they cut away too late or cut in too early. Like there is a shot in when they're running from the raptors where there's a guy with a flashlight. That's all he has, a flashlight, and he holds it up to camera and he's screaming at camera, that the camera stops and he's just screaming at camera. Like if it was the point of view of the raptor, he'd be eaten. And if it wasn't the point of the view of the raptor, why is he standing screaming? But anyway,
the guy who's running, he's running away and then he stops and spins.
Yes.
And it's a high angle shot. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And the fact that you can remember that just from me describing that means that it, of course, stuck out to you, too.
It's because I saw his face and it was probably only like six frames too long, but it was just like, that's one of those moments that where Spielberg has these moments that like teeter on the edge of cheesy, but everything else around them is usually so realistic that you like let them slide as part of the magic of cinema or whatever. But in this particular frame here, like we're not scared of the raptors. There's no drama about, you know, the people being picked off from the back of the line and the 15 people who are literally touching each other in line moving forward, like have no clue that anything is happening behind them because the director hasn't told them to react yet. Like, you don't care about any of that. So then when you see this guy's ridiculous over-the-top face as he points the light right into the camera, you're just like, you hear somebody off camera screaming and yell and look really terrified. That looked really good. But like, even after Peter Stormare gets yelled at when the Stegosaurus comes running through the camp, and Roland says, whatever, like, last time I leave you in charge or whatever, the camera pushes in on him, and then he looks from camera right to camera left off in the distance, and the camera continues to push in on his face and push in on his face, and it's like, why? I don't care about this person. Why are we still here trying to look for some subtle emotional cue of his performance? Like, there's nothing there. Like, why are we here still?
Yeah. And okay, so like we talked about, there's an enormous major flaw with San Diego, and let's get into some of those other things, like you're saying with the camp and the bad guys.
Well, I have a couple of questions about sort of related to this.
Yes.
Do you think that one of the reasons that this is bad / the performances are lacking is that there are just too many people in this movie?
I feel like there are too many people that are not serviced well, because
I guess could you possibly service all of these characters well? Because there are a lot of people who we are ostensibly supposed to know their names and care about.
You could service all of them well if you removed San Diego from this film. I feel that would give you like 20, 30 minutes of extra runtime on this to explore these characters. But we don't have that because we have to shoehorn in Godzilla and King Kong homages at the end. And because of that, we are compressing all the things about these characters, quote unquote, into just them spouting stuff at one another in between things. Like there is a scene with Pete Postwaith and the guy who plays RJ in like basically a hunting camp, and they have a fight that breaks out, and they get recruited into this T-Rex thing, and that is supposed to be after Jeff Goldblum is talking to John Hammond, that they get recruited into the bad guy team, and they have some development about what Peter Postwaite's Roland Tembo's character is supposed to be interested in and why he's doing this, his game hunting thing. But we don't get any of that. Instead, the first time we see Roland in the actual film, because that had been cut, is we see him in the front of the little ATV or whatever it is going through the jungle when the engine guys are dropped off and they're doing their woo, lasso all the dinosaurs scene. That whole montage. In the middle of that, he pauses to turn around and give a monologue to Ludlow about how he is sick of, you know, rich dentists on safari and blah, 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 blah. And he really delivers like an enormous speech. But in the audience, you're staring at him like, who are you? Like, why are you doing this? Like, we can put together from context that he is the hunter that has been hired by Ludlow, but like, he's just literally dropped out of the sky and put into this film at that point. And we don't...
You can tell he's a very serious man because he wears short-sleeve jackets and very short shorts and a big hat.
Mm. Who likes short shorts? We like short shorts. But
It makes him more nimble for hunting the world's deadliest game.
Well, you need that range of motion, really.
It helps to be able to crouch behind mm-hmm. things,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're wearing your like sand colored safari gear in the jungle too. You really want to blend in with the foliage.
It isn't even the jungle; it's redwood forest. They shot in Eureka. This is the redwood forest that they shot Return of the Jedi's speeder bike stuff in and everything. Like,
wow, they made that look really bad. Like, some of this I could swear is just like, I don't know, 30 square yards of set that they built on a back lot somewhere. It just does not look interesting or real. Or
there are parts of it that are set built on a back lot, and usually that's the nighttime stuff. Like the trailer at night when it's being dangled over and all that stuff, that's all set on the Universal lot. And you have the stuff with the nighttime scene where they're running through the high grass and the raptors are coming after them. You'll notice that the background very conveniently goes to pitch black behind them. Like, no highlights or sky or anything, pitch black. And that's because there's nothing back there. there are some of those cheats in here. And a lot of the San Diego stuff was shot in Burbank, but whatever. It's Southern California. It's all fine. There's so much of this that is just sort of weirdly, weirdly tight. And I do wonder if some of it also has to do with wanting to fill up the area that you're filming with atmosphere. They seem to focus more on atmosphere in this film than they had in the previous one. So there's a lot of like smokiness.
And also like desk lamps in the foreground.
Yeah. Well, desk lamps are important because that lets you blow out everything, which is really painterly.
Yeah. In the upstairs of the area where they're prepping the RVs and the trucks and stuff, where it's just full of architect desks for some reasons, everything is in the foreground. The people are so far in the background, they might as well have been recorded with ADR because you can't even like see their faces or their mouths. Like, also, the one that really, really drives me nuts is when Malcolm first goes to Hammond's house and he's talking to what's his name, bad guy, who is like in the foreground
Ludlow.
With the low angle. Yeah, he's like, keep signing this book until the scene is over. And Malcolm is way in the background, having like one of his more dramatic moments in the movie where he's actually like trying to defend himself and, you know, talk about all the people who died and how he was trying to get justice for them by sharing his story and stuff. And, you know, quiet guy in the foreground is just like, well, you signed an NDA. You really shouldn't have done that or whatever and blah, blah, blah. And just like walks away. It's like that shot is so poorly set up and just like none of it was working. They should have just reshot that. It was very bad.
Yeah. I don't particularly appreciate how flared and blown out everything is behind them, and also the with the framing. There's some other stuff in Hammond's office too, where they decided to go really low for some reason. I don't know if it was to try to make Hammond's office feel bigger, but it is strange because I was watching a behind the scenes featurette where you can actually see the reverse angle of the documentarians looking at where they're filming from. And Jeff is basically like crouched down, like arms almost straight perpendicular to the table in order to get in close enough to do the shot that they wanted to hit for them at the desk. And Hammond is basically almost seated and crouching. It is kind of absurd that they were so low to get that shot to work.
I bet you either Spielberg or the cinematographer, when they were talking about this movie and watching a bunch of other movies to get ideas, somebody popped in Alien 3 and they're like, fascinating. The camera is on the ground the entire time. Let's do that. That sounds really cool. And then they forgot the part where it's really annoying and doesn't help anything.
No, because to go back to the previous film, shot by Dean Cundey, and I know that Spielberg likes to call out his lenses and likes to call out what he wants to do and stuff like that, but I have no other explanation for why this is other than, you know, Dean Cundey was shooting it, so for some reason it was at a human height most of the time.
We have to, like, reverse engineer it because nothing in this movie feels like Spielberg made it. Like, the framing, the camera moves, the pacing, the emotion, like, nothing in this movie feels like a Spielberg movie to me.
It is very weird because it's like we don't need to see the ceiling in Hammond's office. That's not relevant to anything. Why are we looking like up at them? Like, we should really be at a more relatable distance, a relatable height to them. Like, when Hammond is in his bunker talking to Malcolm when he's injured, like, they're you know, we're even above Hammond. We're at a height where we might be as the audience, because Hammond is kind of a short guy. But that all just makes the scene feel like human and relatable. Whereas in this one, we're like a tiny little ant observing the
right.
world.
Okay, here, I'll give you my BS Hollywood Reporter interview after this movie came out when somebody asked me why the camera was like that. Well, in the first movie, we were the people and we were stunned at the massive scale of these dinosaurs. And in the second movie, we kind of wanted to play off of that feeling a little bit more and take it a little bit further. And we got a little bit lower now from a lower perspective because in this movie, the people are the real monsters. They are large and looming the way the dinosaurs were in the first movie. So we really wanted to give you a larger sense of scale of the actors themselves.
That is some good BS.
It's such BS. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, they're people. Why are we not near the people who are saying the things? Like,
no.
In every instance where the people are being dramatic, we're really far away from them. And then everyone else just gets this, like, everyone gets their moment to, like, take two steps towards camera while the camera, like, slowly pushes in and tilts up into their face while they just make some sort of, like, opened mouth stare at nothing. And it's like, if there were some drama on either side of this shot, maybe I would, like, read into this emotion that they're trying to present here, but there's nothing. So it's just, like, them staring over the camera for 15 seconds, and then we cut to something else.
What's also strange is you contrast that with some of the really wide shots, where, like, where Julianne Moore is, like, dodging the Stegosaurus's tails when they're swinging at her.
Oh, God, that shot is so poorly choreographed.
It is incredibly poorly choreographed. Did you know that they built a practical Stegosaurus and tail and head and everything? It wasn't, like, a fully integrated thing, but there were, like, two parts you basically could cut between. But the decision was made to not really use that. So she's just in this empty field dodging things, and Steven Spielberg is shouting on a megaphone, go
and somersault
now, tail
and stand yeah, and move dodge and left and right.
Yeah. And so you know, it's not really her fault, and we're not cutting away to any other reverse angle of this. So we were just looking at this enormous wide shot of two Stegosauruses in frame, fully in frame, with a teeny tiny Julianne Moore trying to somersault through invisible Stegosaurus tails. It is not a good decision. And one of the interesting things when I was watching this featurette, because I was like, is there maybe another reason why this is like this? Because in the first film, they had made some decisions about you know, how they would compose these shots before they went into doing it. And in this one, apparently, Steven Spielberg did not want to do the stop motion animatics to decide how the shots would be put together for the dinosaur stuff. So what they ended up doing was just deciding on set on the day, like whatever Steven wanted to shoot. And the VFX guy is like, that made it a little more complicated, but you know, it allowed you know, Steven to have the flexibility he wanted. And I feel like this is the part where people incorrectly ascribe fault on computers, on CGI as ruining films, when I would say that Steven Spielberg, not knowing the limitations, composed these shots in a way where you would see all the limits burned into film for time, all time, where we're seeing these enormous wide shots of these animals in ways that they don't really work very well. And we don't have coverage to cut in a way to some of the stop motion puppetry and back out again. There are some stop motion puppets in this one still. Stan Winston is still involved. We get some raptor heads digging and stuff like that, where we barely see something moving around. We don't have the full like raptor stop, the full raptor animatronic stuff that we used to have in the first film. They just didn't bother with that at all. So we just get the CG raptors the entire time, whenever you see them full body.
Yeah, and on this wide shot, like, an argument could be made either way. If you were standing on set there talking about which perspective to shoot this from, whether it's Goldblum's or Julianne Moore's in the center of this stuff, you know, you could harken back to Jurassic Park 1, where we were sitting with Dr. Grant and Malcolm in the second Jeep when the T-Rex breaks through and starts attacking the kids' Jeep. And, you know, you're kind of at this sort of, like, wide reserve watching this giant monster terrorize your friends, and you're sort of powerless to do anything about it. So you're standing there just sort of like taking it all in, and you're kind of in awe of what's happening as well, because it is utterly terrifying. In this particular instance, like, it's midday, it's Stegosaurus's, she's doing like somersault rolls around, so that wide perspective, it doesn't give you that same feeling of like, well, we can't intervene because, you know, what are we going to do? We'll end up getting ourselves killed too. We're powerless to just sort of like help her at this moment. There's nothing we can do. We just have to wait for this moment to pass, and then we'll do our best to help her, because she's like in there just like doing gymnastics, getting around this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's clearly not that perilous. Whereas, you know, an alternate way to do this would be to shoot it from next to Julianne Moore's perspective of these giant tails flying around and stuff. And that probably would have been a more successful version of this particular scene, where you actually would have felt some level of, I don't know, urgency or drama or something. But just still, the way she's very handily, like, ducking out of the way when these three massive dinosaurs are trying to defend their young and, like, I don't know, either scare her away or kill her or whatever. They're just, like, completely unable to do that because, what, she's a tiny, bendy woman compared to their giant slow tails or something? Like, none of it is threatening or menacing in any way. She just, like, you know, she does a couple stutter steps and rolls in the dirt, and then she's fine.
Well, she also gets into the tree trunk, and then they have the spikes go through the tree trunk. Which,
oh, of course, she crawls through a tube, because yeah, why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one way to get your practical Stegosaurus tail in there.
You got to have a mix in every scene. You got to have some CG and some practical, so keep the audience on their toes.
But you could definitely tell it was the CG and the practical. But I appreciate, I guess, the log shot, as silly as it is to be inside of a confined space that could be punctured by enormous spikes, or just trampled over, basically. While that may be silly, it's also at a more relatable height. And as you're saying, we could have an establishing shot from that perspective of the wide shot of the two of them, just so we can see there are two Stegosauruses in relation to where she is on the set. But then we should have cut in to all of the close-up action of her dodging these tails. And we didn't need to see the entire Stegosaurus, let alone two Stegosauruses, in relation to her when she's dodging the stuff.
Yeah, this kind of movie, it makes me like feel bad on a personal level too, because you see stuff like this, and I can put myself in the shoes of the people who are on set and making these decisions, and then getting in post, and you go, oh crap, we don't have the coverage and we thought we were good because we were doing a thing here and we're all professionals and we were using our best logic in that given moment and it just doesn't work. And oh my God, you know, I guess we'll get it next time or whatever, but like that's way smaller stakes for me when I'm like making a commercial where I shoot for a day versus a $73 million movie or something. But like, it makes me feel bad because you see the thought process. You know, you don't want to be the guy who goes like, all right, Mr. Spielberg, I know you have this vision in your head of how this scene is going to play out, but just in case you're horribly wrong, let's go shoot some coverage. Like, that's not a thing that somebody would say on set because he's Steven Spielberg and he's got this his directing style. He's got it in his mind. He's going to shoot the shots that he needs and then he's going to move on if he doesn't think he needs something. But there is a very, very noticeable absence of coverage in this movie, or they just got in the edit and decided, like, yeah, that's fine. Like, there's no way they got in the edit and watched this and said, good enough, ship it. Like, they had to have gotten there and then felt some of these things that we're feeling, unless they were just, like, so deep into their own, like, Jurassic Park Bible of, like, how we do things and very deep in their own BS mindset from coming off of the first movie and then doing the second one that it didn't even occur to them that, like, they had to put in effort to make the audience like register with these characters they've never met before. I don't believe that. I feel like there was an oversight on set where they didn't have enough footage or something. Like, I don't know how you get into the edit and decide that this is what you wanted it to look like.
No. And there's so much of this that there just seems like there's an inattention to the detail that we had previously. And I lament that because I really think the first one, was paying attention. Like it was very conscientious about, the dinosaurs, how much we should see of the dinosaurs, how in awe we should be of the dinosaurs, how the dinosaurs should relate to the humans, etc. And in this one, it really seems like that's all gone out the window. We even have some of these technical details, that we're picking apart here. Another one I will mention that I noticed when I was rewatching it the other day, is that, at 45 minutes into the film, when the Triceratops is breaking out of the camp because the hippies let all the animals loose to murder everybody. The Triceratops's black levels don't match the environment the Triceratops is in. Parts of the black levels are right, but because the set is so foggy, like the head is too dark, but the tail is okay. It's weird. And then there's a tiny little flick of the tail where the tail is comped over the head of the foreground guy for like a couple frames, like one or two frames. And I haven't counted it out and done all that because I don't have the recording medium to do that. But I was watching it and just it caught my eye and I just rewound and watched it again. And whereas in the first film, like there's literally a frame of the raptor missing in the T-Rex's mouth. You don't care because you're so wrapped up in what's happening. But I'm so ambivalent about what is going on in the film that I'm watching this tail swing over an actor's head in incorrect Z space. And I'm just like, oh, geez, this film, ILM.
And it doesn't help, too, that you're staring directly at that actor, too, because what is that actor doing? He's standing next to a car and like, should I run left? Should I run right? Should I run left? Should I run right? I'm just going to stand right here, I guess.
Well, they didn't,
and it's just like 20 seconds long.
Yeah, they didn't know how to choreograph any of this. They're just like, and there's a Triceratops, and then so it's just like you stand there, and you're just like, ah, I'm scared. There's a Triceratops.
Nobody is acting like a human being should act in any of these situations, whether they had seen dinosaurs before, not seen dinosaurs before, or anticipating seeing dinosaurs, or super jaded about them, like whatever. Nobody is acting like a rational human being. They're acting like actors being told what to do, and it's very off-putting.
Yeah, and even I would say that the closest we get to people behaving in a manner that we might expect is at the beginning of the film. Jeff Goldblum is very against the idea of anybody going on this island, and he's very against the any further continuation of experimentation or of observation of these animals. He thinks that it can only go awry. He thinks that only bad things can come from it. And so he is representing our viewpoint in the audience of, yes, literally, we saw the whole first film. All this bad stuff can happen. And Hammond seems to be delusional about how they can still do some good stuff. Now, we get to everybody else in the film, and none of them do anything believable. And the rest of the time, Jeff Goldblum behaves in a way that is not natural at all after that point. And not only not natural, but also unlike how he had behaved in the previous film.
Which right, is, for a guy who is, like, concerned about his girlfriend and his daughter and stuff, you know, being concerned is one thing, and that's kind of what he's playing. And he's a little manic being drawn, you know, back and forth between his daughter and his girlfriend trying to figure out, you know, what do I need to say to these people to get them off this island? But he literally almost got eaten by a T-Rex. He should be traumatized for life to the point where he would be screaming in people's faces like, we are getting off of this. Are you kidding me? There is no way in hell we are going there. I don't care what anyone says. Like, that was, I literally almost died. I got smashed through a wall by a dinosaur. Are you kidding? No. Yeah. No. Like, he should be screaming at these people. And he's just, you know, he's being, like, nervous Jeff Goldblum and like, no, we need to go now. Don't go outside. It's dangerous out there. I need to talk you out of this. And it's just like, he's close. He, you know, once they get to the trailer, he's still close to being a human, but still, like, not nearly as emphatic as I would have imagined that actual human being would be.
No, and he's much more like his character in Independence Day than he is, like, Ian Malcolm from the first film, which I guess makes sense because that was an intervening movie. But
you're talking about the first Independence Day?
Yeah, the first Independence Day. we haven't talked about the second one. But yes, it is also unbelievable, too, once he finally catches up to the objective that he has of getting Sarah. And there is a completely unbelievable scene where they're shouting for Sarah, and Vince Vaughn shouts Sarah Harding, Dr. Sarah Harding, and he says, how many Sarahs do you think there are on this island? But right after that, they see the Stegosaurus, blah, 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 and Sarah Harding was basically on the other side of a log while they were shouting, and it was just like, oh, hey, guys, what's up? And this is, it is so strange, because he sort of is mad at her a little bit, but then they give her a camera and they let her, like, immediately get into danger and do nothing, and then they get back to the trailer and he's upset about that, but there's a fire and they put it out and they find out that his daughter had stowed away, and so he's mad at her, but, like, in a clean your room kind of a way, like, not in a you stowed away to a dangerous island full of death kind of a way. It is very weird, and you don't really believe his anger, especially when he gets into the trailer and is arguing with Julianne Moore and telling his daughter to go outside, and then, you know, don't go outside, it's dangerous out there. And it's supposed to be like a moment of levity in that, but it just really comes across as he's not taking this seriously. He doesn't seem to have this. He doesn't seem to have the urgency to this, and then, instead of trying to get off of the island, they just make all these half-hearted attempts at phoning and radio and stuff like that until they see the engine helicopters, and they go follow the engine helicopters, and then they realize that they're bad guys, and then Vince Vaughn reveals, the dramatic reveal, that he's an eco-terrorist, and he's going to go use his bolt cutters to let all the animals out. And Sarah,
eco-terrorist with bolt cutters, yeah.
Yeah, and Sarah Harding is going to go with him, but Malcolm had been so concerned for her safety that he's like, oh, well, whatever. I guess I can't control her. She's just going to go release all these dinosaurs, and we have no other way to get off this island. So I'm just going to go sit back while she does that, I guess. And then they abduct a dinosaur and take it back, and then they're in the high hide, and it's just, there's so much of this. It doesn't ring true that, like, you're just like, no human would behave this way. And there's supposed to be some dramatic tension here where it's like,
like, Julianne Moore's like, I don't need you to rescue me. Why didn't you rescue me from that terrible cocktail party we went to the other month? Like, I would have grabbed her by the shoulders and shaken her. Like, these are dinosaurs that are going to eat you, not make small talk for 2 hours that it's going to make you uncomfortable. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, they tried to go for the same thing they went for with Dr. Sattler from the first film, where they wanted to have somebody who could look out for themselves in a way. They wanted to have a sort of more feminist female protagonist in a sense, but she does all these incredibly ridiculous things that Dr. Sattler did not do in the first film. And so you just find yourself criticizing all of her inconsistent and weird decisions that she's making, because she's making these decisions because the writers need her to get into these situations. And it undermines her efficiency and intelligence and competence in a way that Dr. Sattler didn't have to concern herself with, basically. That character was not undermined in the same way in the first film. But in this one, at every turn, it's basically like, yeah, I'm just going to go into this camp and like use bolt cutters, and yeah, let's take this T-Rex back to our camp. And I know that the T-Rex has the largest olfactory sense in the world, so I'm going to wander around this island covered in T-Rex baby blood and rub it on every fern that I see. And maybe it's just because she's a big fan of like red ferns and she wants to paint the world red, but whatever. She's rubbing T-Rex baby blood everywhere. And she does not connect those dots. And you're like, you're smart enough on the one hand to say these things, but your character is written to not understand the situation enough or not be able to correctly move on this situation, because you fail to do even the most basic things the audience knows for not just like a minute or two. Like, we're talking like there is a montage where they walk across the island for a day covered in baby blood. So it is something where it makes her seem incredibly incompetent and poorly skilled, where she didn't need to be written that way. It is a total failure on the writer's part. And
yeah.
The other good guys that are with them, Vince Vaughn, he's an idiot, and he does ridiculous things like the bolt cutters for the dinosaurs, and yeah, you're free now, man, you know, and he's basically like in it for the chicks, I guess, is what he says at one point, and like he is just sort of vaguely concerned with stuff, but is a videographer with camcorder stuff, and I don't know, he's very poorly written. And when they finally get off the island, he just disappears through the entire San Diego segment. So he might as well have died. At least you could have given us that, Steven. But he does things like remove the shells from, the bullets from the shells.
Yeah, he takes apart two large, like, elephant gun bullets so that Roland can't kill a T-Rex. But he does it quickly, quietly, by hand, apparently. Somehow.
Yeah. His other secret character trait, besides being an eco-terrorist, in addition to being a videographer, is that he's an illusionist. He's just awful. And we have Eddie, the mechanic guy, who we can't get too attached to because he basically does nothing other than argue with Ian Malcolm the entire time. And he has a gun that's supposed to be all big and fancy, and then he never gets to use it. And he's torn apart like a wishbone.
Well, because the sight gets tangled in the net, and he can't use it.
Yeah, and he also has, like, I don't know, three or four pratfalls in the mud when he's trying to get the winch to work.
That was a few too many.
Yeah, that was just it was just like, come on, like there's just no reason for dragging this on any further. And we have the daughter who is present sometimes, but like also at other times is just like not really there in the movie. It's weird because you would think that part of the focus with these dinosaurs, we get a scene with the Stegosaurus and the baby, and it's supposed to be protecting the baby, and we get a scene with the T-Rexes and the baby, and it's supposed to be protecting the baby, and then the rest of the movie is basically about protecting this T-Rex baby. You would think that they would try to juxtapose that with Ian Malcolm protecting his family, protecting his daughter. But they basically just have the daughter there, and she says some like non-child dialogue things.
Not even remotely childish, but they're mixing their metaphors too. Like, you know, the whole thing that Dr. Harding is looking for is like to prove that, you know, her personal mission is that dinosaurs have gotten a bad rap from pop culture over the past 100 years. Ugh. And that everyone thinks that the T-Rex is just like a monster that eats people and abandons its young and stuff, and she really wants to document how nurturing T-Rexes are to their young or whatever. But like, they lean so much on that throughout the movie, these dinosaurs are just like, even more so, it annoys the crap out of me in Jurassic World, but like the T-Rex's go-to moves are putting their heads next to people and things and sniffing. Like, they're not acting like giant dinosaur monster or just like carnivores that would just like tear into stuff with their teeth to find out what it is, like a shark. Like, just like figure out what it is, bite it, see if you can eat that thing. Oh, nope, can't eat that. Oh, I can eat this over here. It's just like they're just meandering around and sort of like trying not to get in the way of stuff. And it just, it again, just like the people, feels like something that's being directed by a guy with some joysticks and a camera guy and a director just shouting at it.
Well, yeah, but I want to finish up with the rest of the main cast before we move on to criticisms involving the T-Rex and the raptors.
It's all related, but yes, go ahead.
Peter Postlethwaite, who we already criticized, is not having really an opening introductory at all. We just know that he's a game hunter who wants to hunt his game, and he's evil, but also doesn't want to kill people. But like, it's weird. He has a weird respect thing with Julianne Moore's character. And he also seems to recognize the danger of the T-Rex, and he recognizes that she has blood on her and is concerned about her well-being, but does not also, like her,
connect
the dots.
And then he's like, hey, you, nobody tells the kid that somebody died from the dinosaurs. Like, why are you telling her that nobody's allowed to tell the kid about, that doesn't even make any sense. No. Everyone can hear you talking.
They're literally like 5 feet away. But, because it's staging. But and you have Peter Ludlow mumbling his way through this entire experience. His character is so wishy-washy and weaselly, but like not in a fun Paul Reiser Aliens kind of a way. Like, I wish he had been written more like that, where he had more of a broad vision, where this character is just sort of, I don't know how to describe it. Like, there's not much to him. He just sort of mumbles and stuff. And then when he finally dies, there's upbeat, heroic, cheerful music because the baby T-Rex has learned how to kill, and it killed the bad guy. And we as the audience are supposed to be happy that he died? I don't understand what his point was in this film. It is so bizarre. Because he's also inept. His bumblingness, I guess, could have been punished legally without like necessarily needing to like have him be eaten. You have AJ Sidhu, who is a supposedly hunting partner from India, but looking at the character, looking at the actor who's from England, and look at any other photo of him, it appears that he has some heavy brown makeup applied to his face in this film, which is not, I guess, the first time Steven Spielberg has done that, but he probably should stop doing that, I would say. And you have Dr. Burke, who is the I don't know, weirdo comic book store guy, dinosaur expert, who is not really much of an expert. He knows what their names are, but he seems to guess their behavior is completely wrong, and he's supposed to be an homage to the dinosaur consultant on this movie's foe or nemesis or something. I don't know. They seem to have a polite disagreement over some things. But anyway, that was supposed to be, he's supposed to be dressed, and he's supposed to behave as if it was this other dinosaur expert, that was supposed to be a joke, I suppose. And that concludes all of the important characters in this, with the exception of the daughter, Vanessa Lee Chester as Kelly Curtis, who is Ian's teenage daughter from a failed relationship, which is, I feel, good casting, bad writing, really awful writing. I don't have a problem with her as a child actress. I usually have an enormous problem with child actors, but I'm fine with her. It just, they gave her like really awful things to do. And there are large stretches of this movie where she's doing nothing but walking around aimlessly
and breathing at various speeds.
Yeah. So they did not know how to utilize her. I feel like they also had a poor joke that did not work, where they have, the scene where she's first revealed to have stowed away, and she's arguing with Ian Malcolm, and we have Eddie and Vince Vaughn's character basically on the hood of the Jeep talking to one another, and they're like, oh, you see a family resemblance? And he's like, a little bit. And you could have just skipped that. Like, we didn't really need that, like, thing there. Like, they didn't need to actually look the same or to have that joke. Like, it works fine. You could theoretically, with better writing, believe that they were related to one another without that necessarily occurring. But yeah, that's dumb.
They're like, we made a rather clever and subtle joke in the first movie when he says he has a ton of kids and he's occasionally married, and that was kind of clever. So let's see if we can continue that in this movie. And that no is the answer, apparently.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, because it's like, oh, I'm not the one who flew to Paris and decided to leave you. And it's just like, what? The expository stuff is just weird. And she's like, I just want to be punished sometimes. I'm a kid. Blah, blah, blah. It's just weird dialogue. Like, they gave her just awful things to do. But
they wrote three versions of that scene and then just stuck them all together. And it's like, yeah, whatever. We'll do all of it.
And
since it's a one shot, like, you can't cut anything out.
It doesn't work. It really does not work. And again, I don't fault her. I fault the writing. Now, let's go to the dinosaurs, like you were saying, with the T-Rex and the raptors, who are incredibly dangerous creatures that can kill you single-handedly or take 10 years to gently scratch a backpack off of you. Those are the two modes that they have.
The problem is the dinosaurs are playing to the scale of the scene and not to the scale of what they actually are. Like, the T-Rex sticking its face inside of the tent to sniff.
Well, I mean, dinosaurs are covered in scales.
Or are they?
They're playing to the scale of the scales. Yes.
The T-Rex wouldn't stick its face inside the tent to sniff the bloody shirt. It would, like, just, like, walk through and just, like, smush all of that stuff and then just, like, root through it with its snout or something, or, like, just bite a portion of it and tear it away. Like, the idea that they're, like, being very delicate about where they move in and out of stuff, and, like, the way we introduce both the two T-Rexes in the trailer, where they both just, like, put their faces parallel to the windows so we can see them, and they both just immediately start, like, growling instead of just, like, I don't know. They're not acting like animals. They're acting like animatronics.
Yeah, well, that's because when they're first introduced in that scene where we have them lean in and look through the windows, it is a direct reference to the first time we saw the T-Rex lower its head next to the window when what's her face? The little girl is sitting in the back seat. When Lex is sitting in the back seat. And you see the T-Rex lower behind her. And in this one, we have the same thing where they want to have the T-Rex lower behind, but then you also want to cut to having two of them. But again, with staging, one of them is behind them and they're looking through the other window, and it's supposed to be a surprise that it's behind them, but then we cut and there's one in front of them too. So they didn't react to the one that dropped in front of them when they were reacting to the one that was behind them. It's really weird. But they're just staring for what feels like an eternity before they actually start doing stuff with the thing. And it's supposed to be tense. Like, oh no, this is going to go wrong. Like, this can only go poorly. As Jeff Goldblum says, you know, like, bad stuff will happen here. But it takes an incredible length of time and is also, how should I say this? They are being, like you said, dainty with what they're doing. Like, they're not just sort of mauling this trailer and trying to get their baby out. You could argue they don't know what a trailer is. They don't know that a baby is necessarily in there. They just smell the baby. Their vision is supposedly still based on movement in this film.
They're kind of dumb and they're big. And, yeah, like, if they knew that the thing that they wanted was in there and they couldn't get in there, they would just start, like, pushing it or stepping on it or smashing it or something. And then the idea that they're going to, like, pick up the baby and walk it to the front door and set it down and then gently, quietly close the door and like back away and that's going to be okay is insane. Like, no, if they open that door and they're holding the baby and the T-Rex is there, it's going to bite them. Like, I don't, like, even if it accidentally bites the baby too, it's going to lunge at them. That, like, that's just animal nature. Like, it's not going to be so, like, it's not going to just peer through a window on both sides and growl for a long time until you, like, get all flustered and decide to, you know, figure out a solution by handing them back their bandaged baby dinosaur. None of it even feels remotely real. And the only reason that shot worked in the first Jurassic Park is because it was surrounded on all sides by a dinosaur walking around like a dinosaur. Like, there was one shot of an eye through a window, and the rest of it was just a big dumb animal clobbering into stuff.
Yeah, and it was trying to figure out what the Jeep was and poking at it and prodding it and breaking the glass. And in this one, they don't really seem concerned with that. And then when they do attack the trailer, and it is being pushed over the side, then they disappear for a long time, but then they come back when Eddie is trying to save them. Why? Unclear. But apparently they needed to go away because the script said that they needed to have this other stuff happen, and then they needed to come back because the script needed this other things to happen. So it's just whatever the script god says. That is what is happening in these scenes.
Have a winch in there too somewhere. Somebody's got to slip while trying to hook up the winch.
Mm-hmm. Also, I have to say, I do not care for the spider webbing on the glass. It doesn't really make any sense. Like,
what, when she's dangling there before it breaks?
Yeah, she's on the glass, and it's supposed to be dramatic that she's holding on, and then he's gonna Ian Malcolm's gonna come down the side and pick her off of there, because if she tries to move, she might break the glass and just fall right through. However, the glass is spider webbing and cracking from her fingertips, which doesn't make any sense because her fingertips are not made of, like, I don't know, like hypersonic diamond resonators. Like, there's nothing that is going to be causing them to break at those points. The other spider webbing, sure, fine, whatever, but like literally at her fingertips, that doesn't make any sense. But they scoop her up out of there, and it's all this dramatic stuff, and then they have the rope. Is the rope tied to something? It's tied to the tree, but then it slips, but he's doing the winch, so he doesn't know, and da-da-da-da-da.
A very dramatic scene that goes on for a long time that has nothing to do with dinosaurs.
No. And then when they finally... And there is tension in that scene, especially if you haven't seen this before at all, because Vince Vaughn might die. Sarah Harding and Ian Malcolm will probably be fine, but you might be like, yes, this is Vince Vaughn. He's going to go. But that's not what happens. He survives too. Unfortunately, it's Eddie, who gets the death, by the dinosaurs who show up, but then the dinosaurs meander off again. And then who saves them from the trailer, but the bad guys, and they're all upset because all their stuff's broken. But
they finished climbing up the last 2 feet of the fake cliff that was there. Ugh. And then a hand comes down and it's the bad guys.
Yeah.
And they're all there just out of the nick of time because the dinosaurs are gone.
Doesn't make any sense either. Where did the dinosaurs quietly go? But it is really weird. And then when we go to the raptors, when they're going towards the old ops center, to use the radio there because their radios have been destroyed and they're going through the high grass, there is a very dramatic overhead shot where you can see the lines in the grass of the raptors coming up to them. And that was in the trailers for this movie. I remember that distinctly. And that was supposed to be a big deal. It was supposed to be very exciting. How it plays, though, is you see people just dropping and then immediately a prosthetic rubber tail that's about 3 feet long waggles up in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is not as dramatic as you might expect from the wide shot. But they have everybody basically die from that group because they were all running from the T-Rex that found them at the camp. And the T-Rex, like you said, it doesn't make any sense the way it approaches the tent and like gingerly inserts its head in there like it's just an enormous labradoodle, and is trying to get the bloody rag off of the ceiling.
It's like practically it would be laying on its stomach in order to scoot its head like perpendicular to or parallel to the ground straight into the tent like that.
Yeah, it would have to be very intentionally not trying to move in order to not move that tent, because there is no way that it was just sort of brushing up against the constrictions of the tent or anything. So it doesn't make any sense, because it's like, I'm going to just gently sneak my head in there. Hopefully the humans won't wake up. I don't want to disturb anybody.
It's like a big dog.
Yeah. Yeah. And the people, it's supposed to be dramatic because it's confined space. But it's dramatic because it's a confined space, because the filmmakers want it to be that way, not because it makes any sense. So you're sitting there in the audience going, this is just a cloth tent. What is going on? And you have Julianne Moore, like, trying to restrain Kelly from screaming her lungs out because there's a giant dinosaur above them. Because Julianne Moore was dumb enough to drag her blood-soaked jacket across the entire island. But
hang it above them as they're sleeping.
This is what I do. I'm just like, you know what? This thing's filthy. Let me put it over my head.
Just in case there's any extra blood on it, it should drip down on us while we sleep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, because Lord knows I want this thing to dry out. But it's so ridiculous. Like, I don't understand. Just throw out the friggin' jacket. Theoretically, you are on a tropical island. What are you doing? But anyway, the blood-soaked jacket, the T-Rex destroys the tent, and everybody freaks out, and there's shooting, and people are screaming, and then there's the other T-Rex, and they're all being chomped and chased, and there's a waterfall, and Burke has a snake in his collar that freaks him out, so he gets eaten by a T-Rex because he jumps away from the wall to get away from the snake, because he's an idiot, and that's the end of him, Bloody Waterfall, and you get them getting out of there, but just running into, like we said, the raptor thing, all the bad guys dying, them getting to where the raptors are just in the nick of time to realize there are raptors there, and then going a different direction down a fiberglass chute that takes them to a boneyard, where they walk to the ops center, but because Jeff Goldblum, like, I don't know, busted his ankle or something, he can't walk yet, so Vince Vaughn goes to walk by himself, which, I don't know, that's like some really poor thinking, but he gets over there and he starts radioing from help, which is, I guess, a good thing in a way, but not like the best way, because then everybody else goes wandering off after him and they're shouting for him. And he doesn't hear them because I guess he has his headphones on. But they are all confronted by raptors, and they're screaming and running around for raptors. And Vince Vaughn is just like, oh, you know what? This seems dangerous. I want to stay up here in my tiny little radio room that's been overrun by vines in 4 years. And
yeah, 4 years has been very harsh for this this particular command center type room, hasn't it?
Yeah, it basically looks like it's aged like 50 years, but it's only been 4.
Except the part where all the electronics still work. You just flip them on, maybe a light bulb sort of pops or whatever, but everything's still functioning. You just got to turn on.
Yeah, yeah.
Move some vines, you know, somebody left their Mac SE still turned on or whatever the hell it was.
It was all geothermal energy. That's what Ludlow says.
Oh, is that the whole place was powered by geothermal energy?
Yeah, as opposed to the first film, but anyway, he reboots the system and you know, holds onto his butt and calls the for the help, but everybody's running from these raptors in the like gas station downstairs, and like it is a weird scene because the set that they get into where they're trying to go up because they can't go out, the daughter is a gymnast, but you only vaguely might remember that from a line she said at the very beginning of the film.
Right. Didn't he miss some sort of, gymnastics recital or whatever they have?
But then she says, I'm no longer, I'm off the team, is what she says. And so that way, when she spins on the bar that looks exactly like gymnastics equipment that they built a set around, and then knocks the raptor out the window, I mean, they didn't do anything to disguise this. It really is just gymnastics equipment that they built a set around. But anyway, she knocks this.
I feel like they disguised it better in The Princess Bride when they have the fight between the two gentlemen up there.
No, I'm not sure. It's might be a draw. They probably did a better job on the sky in this one. But they knock.
What, you didn't like the cotton candy sky?
The cotton candy painted sky that's 10 feet from them. But she knocks the raptor out the window because she hit it so hard with her spinny thing. But and they have a brief little line about how, oh, I can't believe you got kicked off the gymnastics team, because that's supposed to be a nod to the previous thing. But because we've been watching this movie, our brains are dead and we don't remember that. But
and we don't care. We just saw a 90-pound girl spin around and kick a 1,500-pound raptor out a window.
Yeah, and then the rest of this is like, these are supposed to be these horribly terrifying beasts, but they're like, rawr, I'm not touching you. Rawr. Like,
who would win in a fight? One of the world's most deadly predators ever known to man, or a girl who can do gymnastics?
Yeah, or someone who can climb on a Spanish tile roof.
Also, that's not how tile roofs work. They're not all held in place by the bottom.
Even the keystone tile at the bottom. That's how structures
exactly.
work.
They're like ancient arches.
Yeah. But in reverse, they have all this stuff where these incredibly ineffective raptors are doing these things, and like they injure a couple of them, and for some reason they just disappear when the helicopters show up. And like there were like, I don't know, 10 of these things, maybe 15 in the field, and there were like four or five of them chasing them inside of this gas station, and maybe they knocked one out of a window onto the spike. And they have two of them tussling for a little bit. But, like, there is no way that they actually overwhelmed all of the ones that were actually sent there. Unless they're just like, oh, no, it's a helicopter. The jig is up, fellas. Out of here. Skedaddle. It's
very Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's just like, we just need you guys to be threatened. Ta-da! But that's the end of that scene. And then you have them go off back to San Diego because they have abducted this thing. And then we, like we said, there's all of the ridiculous San Diego stuff that makes no sense.
This movie makes me tired and sad.
We should wrap it up with the last scene, which is they have the nephew get murdered by the dinosaur to happy music. And then they cut to CNN stuff on a CRT TV and a special message from John Hammond about preserving things on the island, and the T-Rexes are going back because they've been tranquilized and stuff, and how nature preserves and whatever. And the only person who's awake is the daughter, and the parents apparently got drunk and passed out in their clothes that they were wearing when they were on a T-Rex chase.
No, it's just adrenaline exhaustion. They've had a very long day.
It's been a very long day, yes. And then they have the cut to the island, and you got all the animals living together like it's the Serengeti, with the T-Rexes over on one side with the baby.
I put that along with many other frames in the chat room, but it's just like, why is the last frame of this movie just like, and all of the animals live together in harmony, standing near each other in a field for some reason?
It makes no sense, because this movie is theoretically supposed to be a darker film, according to Steven Spielberg. It is supposed to be this dark and very serious thing, but it is not, and it ends with this happy note that is like, yay, dinosaurs. And it's like, I didn't feel any of that when I was watching this picture. So like,
you know what that last frame says when you're looking at it? It says F it. Like, it says, I don't care anymore. F it. Just show all the dinosaurs and cut to black. Like, that's all that is.
It's just like, this is what all the kiddies want anyway, is sell all your toys. And then that's what they do. It's an incredibly cynical shot that is supposed to be upbeat, because they're also playing the original Jurassic Park theme, which they had eschewed for this film because they wanted to have very serious action music for most of it, except for the parody stuff.
It worked out real well.
Yeah, and so you don't have that music of the awe and the mystery and the mystique of dinosaurs until this very end scene, where it's just like, what? Is this the Land Before Time? What is happening?
They should have spent even more of this movie at nighttime too. Like, I kind of am looking through all of these images. Like, I hate all of the daytime stuff because it's just bad.
What's weird too is it's also like overcast, which you would think would make for better photography, but there's just something about how they shot it where it just makes it look dingy and weird. But
it's not helping anything.
No, none of it's helping. I really just think they should have approached this more carefully than they did, and they should have been a little more thoughtful, and maybe somebody should have said, so why do we care about any of this a couple of times? Because nobody apparently did that.
Yeah, I don't know. All of it just makes me want to quit my job because, like, I see all of the decisions that led to this, and I could totally fall for all of the same mistakes, and it's just like I see how they made a lot of these decisions. It's just like it's all wrong. Like every one of the decisions was wrong, and then like they built on top of the wrongness.
Yeah. Yeah. But
why was that guy so casually listening to a tape with his headphones on when Peter Stormare went off to go to the bathroom? Like, people are getting eaten by dinosaurs. Why are you jamming out? Or like you have to listen to a podcast. Like you never miss an episode of NPR, so you recorded it on tape and brought it with you or something.
Well, I have something special to tell you, Dan. I know that you're regretting that you're in an industry where you can make this kind of mistake, but this is the kind of mistake where you could make $72.1 million on its opening weekend of Memorial Day weekend. $92.6 million for the four-day Memorial holiday in the U.S., which is the biggest opening weekend at the time, surpassing the previous record holder. Do you want to guess what the previous record holder was?
Jurassic Park?
Nope.
I don't know.
Batman Forever at $52.8 million.
You know, I chalk up the opening weekend to just, you know, the excitement that this property was coming back. I mean, Jurassic Park was fantastic. You're gonna give me more of Jurassic Park. That's worth my, well, back in 1997, my $5.25 just to find out what you guys did.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Because this is the ideal movie for the total media blackout copyright Todd Vaziri. Whatever year. But anyway, that, like, this is the kind of thing where you're just like, I don't care. Like, I'm going to go see this no matter what. Like, whatever the reviews say, doesn't matter. I'm going to go watch
it. Which is unfortunately like the same thing that it causes all of these friggin' Marvel movies and all of these terrible Jurassic World movies and stuff.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you noticed, but Jurassic World 2 Fallen Arches has made such an enormously large amount of money. Such an absurdly large amount of money that I am gobsmacked by it, because I would have assumed that everyone would have had more sense than to fork it over for this, but they did, like, for whatever reason. And this is even after seeing the first Lost World movie where you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean,
what a sharp drop in quality from the first film to this film, even with the same people. Just an enormous drop. Precipitous fall.
They did a lot of the same things, but none of it worked.
Yeah. I just
started Googling behind the scenes photos just to look at, like, trying to get a feel for the looks on people's faces. Like, did they know what they were doing when they were shooting this? Did they realize that maybe they were screwed, but they couldn't turn back now? A lot of practical dinosaurs here.
Yeah.
This movie makes me sad.
Womp womp.
Womp wow.
Though I realize that might be politically charged at the moment, but I meant it in the traditional sense.
Oh yeah, no.
Oopsie.
These podcasts are timeless, so there are no current events.
Yeah,
technically, I would like you to look. However, I don't know if you've been keeping track with some of all of the links I've been posting into the chat room, but look at that rain depth one. I think it's the link right before I wrote some bad rain depth. What's going on there? Is that just more of like the same thing that was bad with the black levels? Just a lot of like slightly off volumetrics and depth mapping and stuff.
Well, I think they're supposed to be peering through the rain, but it really...
Why is the rain stopping, like, right over the car?
I don't know. Maybe there's a tree branch over their heads. Like, if you look at the car, there's some clarity on the car, I guess. So they're trying to get it near that. But the T-Rex that's in the background should be as covered in rain as the midsection of the foreground T-Rex, unless there is a mystery branch over that T-Rex's head.
Yeah, it looks just like somebody grabbed a Z-depth pass and used that to cut out where the rain is.
Yeah, except that they also used two different focal depths for that, because the background one, like, that head is basically at the level of the foreground head, which is at the car.
It's tilt shift Z-depth.
That's not how that works. It's not how this works. but yeah, it is... There were some mistakes. Mistakes were made.
Mistakes were made. I think that should be the title of this episode.
Mistakes were made. The Lost World story.
I'm typing it now. Mistakes. We don't even have to look at any of these other ones.
No, but this is also, I think, the only film I can think of where the first film in the series's title is the part that goes after the colon instead of in front. So we have The Lost World, colon, Jurassic Park.
Did you enjoy when Hammond said, "This lost world"?
I did not care for that, no. And Michael Crichton and Steven Spielberg and David Kopp were all three referencing Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World. So that's a reference that's incredibly timely for most children of the 90s. But whatevs.
This movie's bad.
This movie's incredibly bad.
Tell us why this movie isn't bad, people who are listening to this. Tell us what we're missing here. What the value was that we didn't appreciate.
Yeah, or don't. Just say yes.
I want to know what value in this movie am I not appreciating, if such a thing exists. I would like to know if people find value in this.
I don't know if I have the moral the stamina to withstand.
Mm-hmm. Just at me on Twitter. Don't mention Joe.
No, I'm too delicate. My constitution.
I just found the most amazing GIF.
Oh, did you?
I am. It's the fella who makes the face before the raptor jumps. It's so bad.
Oh yeah. See that shot is just too long. Like, what were they thinking?
They're like, well, the camera's got to get all the way up to his face.
No, it doesn't. He's not a title character. He's a top billing. Like, we've never seen it before in our lives.
Oh, it's also nice to know that in 4 years, the technology for flashlights has not advanced between Jurassic Park and Lost World.
No. As we mentioned,
flashlights were the downfall of the first movie.
Yeah. I mean, flashlights are basically a death wish in Jurassic Park world area.
Oh, yeah. As MoveUps has asked in the chat room, what is lighting his face when he turns around?
Well, what's lighting his face is magic, because we need to see the look of terror on his face.
Is it the flashlight bouncing off the underbelly of the impending raptor?
Or it is just a particularly strong beam of moonlight that is highlighting only this field of high grass and nothing else.
Whatever.
Shot like crap.
Anyway, I think we crapped on the whole movie. Is there anything else you want to crap on?
Nope. I think we covered it. Eat it, Steven Spielberg.
eat it like a... I guess the T-Rexes are really the only ones that, like, eat people in this movie.
The compies, too.
Up until the raptor here in the high grass scene, the body count in this movie is about as low as Jurassic Park, which is weird because there's, what, like 6 people in Jurassic Park, and this movie has like 50?
Yeah. But then a lot of them die kind of off camera, a bunch or something. I don't know. We don't really get like a head count of survivors. But it doesn't matter because we didn't care about any of these people.
No, we no.
Mm-hmm.
These people are all stupid.
Yeah. The end.